It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Over 2.7 billion people around the globe use the internet. That's 40% of the world's population. In the next decade, some 5 billion people will come online. What does that mean for how connected we are? The game-changing impact of advanced technology is hardly questionable, but is change synonymous with progress? And can 20th century institutions adapt to a 21st century global society? Today we're putting these questions and more to Ross Lajeunesse, Global Head of Free Expression and International Relations for Google. The World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh is hosting his talk, The Fifth Domain, Freedom and Power in the Digital Age, on Tuesday, March 11th at the Kelly Strayhorn Theater. He joins us now by phone. Ross Lajeunesse, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks very much, Paul. It's great to be with you.
And you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is esspgh@wesa.fm, and you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. How do the laws, ethics, values, and opinions that form the basis for our modern society apply to the digital age? 412-246-2002, the number to call. Ross Lajeunesse, with billions more people coming online in the next decade, what does that mean for just how connected we are?
Right. Well, the way I think about it, Paul, is I think about what life, I'm in my mid-40s, and I think about what life was like when I was a kid. I grew up in a small town in Maine. And when I was growing up, my opportunities for understanding the world were very limited. You know, if I wanted to learn about any topic, you know, I could go to the old set of encyclopedias my parents had. I could maybe go to the local library where my options were only a little bit better. You know, I could maybe have a pen pal, you know, if I wanted to learn about a foreign country, something like that. But my options and my understanding of the world was fairly limited. And now when we think about a school student today, any student with connectivity to the net, she has the ability to do some amazing things. She can say, let's talk about Japan, for example. If she wants to learn more about Japan, she can do things like tour the National Museum of Tokyo online and see that collection for herself. She can read the daily newspapers in Tokyo and use a translation tool to understand them in her own language. She can communicate with, you know, via social networks directly with users in Japan. So that student's ability to understand and connect with the world are so much different and so much expanded from where I was as a kid. And what I think we're going to see as 5 billion more people come online is further expansion of all of our ability to understand the world and to interact with it. Now, what's also interesting, Paul, is just as my ability to understand the world was very limited, my ability to speak to the world as a teenager was even more limited. You know, I could talk to my parents, my family, my classmates. If I were really motivated, I could write a letter to the editor about a particular topic. But now, if anyone has an idea that's interesting enough or, you know, insightful enough or maybe even just funny or creative enough, he or she has the ability to reach millions and millions of people using, you know, online social networks and platforms like YouTube. So I think what we're looking forward to is a world where the connectivity is even greater than it is today. And, you know, as you preface this conversation with, what does it all mean for us is the question.
Indeed, that is the question. And there's also the idea, and it's sort of this age-old thing about science. And once you've discovered the power, how do you harness it for good? And if knowledge is power, and clearly this is all about spreading knowledge to people, people know a lot more simply because they have access to so much more. So then the question becomes, how do you harness all that power for good? And who is kind of watching over all of this to make sure that it doesn't get abused?
Right. Well, I think we have to believe, you know, as Google, we believe that more information and more knowledge is good, because that means more information means, you know, the ability to make better choices and to lead better lives, really. Now, who's watching over all of this stuff is something that my team and I work on quite a bit, because what we're seeing as the power of the net increases and the number of users come online increases, you know, we're starting to see governments increasingly step in and challenge that sort of, you know, that ecosystem. We're seeing increased government censorship. Freedom House, which is an organization that we admire a great deal, did a survey of 60 countries recently, and of those 60, 34 of them, the situation in 34 of them is getting worse in terms of censorship and filtering content online. In our, you know, our own experience is that our services have been blocked in about 32 different countries, and YouTube is fully blocked today in China, Iran, and Pakistan. You know, there are about 31% of the world's current internet users currently live in countries where there is substantial or pervasive online filtering and censorship. So that's very much a part of the challenge that we're facing.
And you have been outspoken in your criticism, particularly of Arab leaders jailing some Twitter users. What do you make of some of what's been happening in places like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Tunisia, or anywhere in the world where information is being censored, the very thing that you and your colleagues at Google are trying to create and have created is in fact being thwarted by some of these totalitarian regimes?
Right. Well, of all the journalists currently imprisoned right now, half of them are online journalists. So, again, we see a lot of governments recognize the power of these online platforms for sharing information, for pushing forward social change, and they just don't like it. You know, we saw in Egypt, what a powerful online platform can do in bringing users together and bringing a community together to protest. In Syria, we've seen videos from Syria being, you know, put online, giving users around the world unprecedented access to the events unfolding there. We saw the same thing in Iran a couple of years ago when videos of the street protests were able to make it out of Iran and reach the worldwide community at a time when typical news media outlets are being censored and blocked. So the internet has allowed, again, unprecedented access to information and allowed citizens all around the world to see these events take place firsthand.
So how do you see this evolving? Is this sort of if this is a flood of information, and these regimes who are sort of stuck in their old ways of dealing with dissent are merely sticking their fingers in a dam, and eventually all that water is going to break through, then how must the old guard, how must the 20th century institutions adapt to this new technology if, in fact, they can't keep it all from coming in, all the information?
Right. Yeah, well, what we're seeing right now is a bit of a race. We're seeing this incredible power of online platforms, and then we're seeing more repressive governments, quickly try and develop new technology, new filtering technology, new censorship technology. You know, and when I think about where this is all heading, Paul, I'm an optimist about it. Because as you said, in many ways, what governments are trying to do is deal with this incredibly powerful tool, the internet, in the same way they've dealt with old traditional media, right? And they just can't. For example, in China, you have 600 million users online right now. And just as the government is rushing to develop new technologies and new capacity to filter and censor, when you have 600 million people online, you've got sort of this unstoppable force. The way I think about it is, you know, let's take the China example. The Chinese government can get the smartest engineers in a room. They can, you know, try and hire and bring them all together and, you know, build this huge building and bring all these smart engineers to build, you know, the absolute best and latest censoring technology. No matter how many engineers the Chinese government gets together in that building, they're never going to be as smart as all the people that they've left outside the room who really want access to information, who want to be able to share their lives, communicate with others around the world. It's really just a numbers game, really, if you think about it that way.
We are talking with Ross Lajeunesse, Global Head of Free Expression and International Relations for Google. If you'd like to join the conversation or have a comment or question, 412-246-2002 is the number to call. 412-246-2002. How has access to so much more information changed your life? How has it impacted your family? What are things that you might like to see in the future, and what concerns do you have? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. You can reach us via email at ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH, and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Ross, before I get onto some other things, I just wanted to refer back to something that you talked about with regard to a Gulf state that had also proposed a policy that would have given states the right to demand content they didn't like to be removed from not only websites in their own country, but globally. And the proposal was voted down. And you said human rights were at the heart of the concern, but that privacy activists and companies such as Google had to take a different tact, usually economical, when dealing with some governments, including those in the Gulf. Explain that, if you would.
Right. You know, we have to use, in our work around the world, we have to sometimes use different arguments with different audiences. I mean, the goal is always the same, which is to advance the free and open internet, to provide more information to users, and to make sure that the web stays, you know, this robust place for information and dialogue, debate, and conversation. But when you're meeting with policymakers, sometimes the arguments you have to craft vary a little bit. In certain parts of the world, you can really talk about these issues in terms of human rights, and the, you know, the need for everyone to have access to information and access to communication. In other parts of the world where they don't have the same history and tradition of, for example, the First Amendment in the United States, or, you know, free and open press in much of the Western world, you approach these arguments often in terms of economic development. You know, because these parts of the world, that's their almost singular focus, is developing their economy, developing their trading relationships and things of that sort. So you really have to make the argument that not only is the net good for users, but it really allows their economies to thrive and participate on equal footing with the other economies in the world. And that if they build a censorship regime or filtering systems, what they're really doing is blocking trade, blocking access to information, free flow of data, and they're segregating themselves and their economies from the global economy. So those are arguments that often resonate when you're dealing with policymakers, government officials in parts of the world, you know, where economic development is the number one priority.
412-246-2002, the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation with Ross Lajeunesse, Global Head of Free Expression and International Relations for Google. And we have Jeremiah from Pittsburgh on the line. Jeremiah, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me. I just wanted to ask a quick question about what the speaker Ross thinks about the deep web. And, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about, you know, Tor and things like that, and I just wanted to see, you know, what his feelings were with that, with getting information and being able to do things anonymously on the internet.
Interesting question. Ross, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating question, because you know, what we're basically talking about is a tool that can be used for a bunch of different purposes, just like encryption can be used for different purposes, you know, and even anonymous speech. You know, we come from a tradition in the U.S., for example, where anonymous speech is valued. You know, the Federalist Papers were written, you know, anonymously hundreds of years ago. There's this sense that there is value in people being able to debate ideas without having to reveal their identity. And as someone, you know, I spent 3 years in Asia working on free expression issues there for the company, and I know that in many parts of Southeast Asia, it's only through anonymous speech that users feel that they are able to discuss government policies, debate issues of the day, and that sort of thing. At the same time, a lot of these technologies can be used for things that we don't like so much. And it's important to keep that in mind. I mean, I think a lot of people, think of this web exceptionalism, when in reality, the same laws apply online as offline, and that should be the case. So there are issues with using Tor or even sometimes encryption for things that we really don't like, you know, child abuse images and the like. And so that's a very difficult issue. And when it comes to something like child abuse images, you know, Google has a zero tolerance policy on that. Wherever we find those images, we take them down, we report them to authorities, and we help in the prosecution of those disseminating them. When it comes to other issues, like cybersecurity, hate speech, extremism, I mean, those are very difficult issues. And what we try and do is achieve the right balance on those issues.
Jeremiah, thank you for that phone call. Sort of shifting to another area here, what are ways, Ross, that people are bypassing technology where infrastructure is not in place?
Bypassing technology where infrastructure is not in place? How do you mean?
Well, in other words, if someone, let's say you have someone in Vietnam, for example, who's working in a rice paddy, and they may not have access to a computer, but they've got a phone that can help them look at weather patterns. Just another way in which somebody standing anywhere in the world can access information that might not otherwise have been at their disposal.
Right. One of the things that we've been working on the past couple of years is recognizing that one of the key issues that we need to address is the access issue. That, that we have about 5 billion people in the world who currently don't have access. And so we're developing a bunch of solutions to make sure that they get the access. But in the meantime, recognizing that they don't have it currently, we've been developing a set of tools for mobile devices, specifically, that actually take online platforms and allow them to be used on, devices that aren't connected to the net. So we sort of re-engineer them and allow them to be used for things. For example, we had a mobile banking application that we were checking out in Africa. But I think working on those things, shouldn't be distracting us from doing what we really need to do, which is to solve the access issue for those 5 billion people. And I'm really proud of some of the work that Google is doing in that regard. We've got, and it's also important to remember that the access issue is not just something that's present, in places like Africa and in the global south, that we have very real access issues all around the world. And that, some of the things we're doing are like fiber rollouts. You may have heard of our Loon project, where we put balloons into the atmosphere, beaming broadband down to users on the ground. So there are
using that, in other words, in places where there are maybe no towers or that kind of thing in place.
Where they're exactly where, like the Project Loon balloons are especially effective. We first launched the trial in New Zealand, where places where it's extremely difficult to reach users, either because of, geography, topography, or just because of the density of users in a given space, make it uneconomic to reach them through, typical ways. So we're really engaged on finding those solutions for the future and getting those 5 billion people online.
Very interesting. Our guest has been Ross Lajeunesse, Global Head of Free Expression and International Relations for Google. The World Affairs Council of Pittsburgh is hosting his talk, The Fifth Domain, Freedom and Power in the Digital Age, on Tuesday, March 11th at the Kelly Strayhorn Theater. For more information, you can go to www.worldpittsburgh.org. We will have a link to that as well on our website at wesa.fm. Again, that is on March 11th. Ross Lajeunesse, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Paul, thanks very much for having me. I'm really looking forward to being in Pittsburgh in a couple of weeks to do the speech at the World Affairs Council.
Safe travel, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up, discover easier ways to find vegan dining choices in the city. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.